Welcome to the ICC podcast on trade and development, making trade work for everyone. Hello, my name is Chris Southworth. I'm Secretary General of the International Chamber of Commerce here in the UK. And on today's podcast episode, I'm pleased to have with me Rosa Crawford, Policy Officer at the Trade Union Congress, Ruth Bergen, Senior Advisor for the Trade Justice Movement, and Ben Richards, International Officer for Unite the Union. Many thanks to my guests for joining me today, and welcome to our listeners for this series of podcasts that we're doing on trade. Just for the benefit of our listeners, the Trade Union Congress is a national trade union federation representing 48 unions and 5.5 million workers across England and Wales. Their role is to support trade unions and to campaign for more and better jobs and a more equal and prosperous society. The Trade Justice Movement is a UK network of 56 organisations and millions of individuals advocating for trade that works for people and planet. It's an inclusive coalition that includes development and environment NGOs, trade unions, human rights bodies, fair trade organisations, and faith and consumer groups. And Unite the Union is the second largest trade union and the largest general union in the UK, representing 1.5 million workers. So we've got a terrific audience. Unite the Union, I should say, is dedicated to protecting workers' rights and promoting equality and diversity in the workplace. So our speakers today are well qualified to talk about the topic. So just to get into our sort of main discussion, just to set the scene a little bit for everybody, obviously all minds are focused on the COVID recovery, and there's more and more dialogue about how we build back better. The big question is, how do we do that? And that's the topic of today's conversation. But we shouldn't be under any illusion that we're in tough times, with global trade expected to be down 13 to 30% over the next 12 months. And the UK is facing its deepest recession in living memory, with GDP down 20%. So it's a good time to reflect on how we build back better and ensure that trade works for everyone. It's an opportunity to think and do things differently and to ensure the benefits of trade are better and more fairly distributed in the future. The big question is, how do we do that? So Rosa, can I just start off just talking about priorities? What are your trade priorities from the TUC?
Well, the Trade Union Congress had our annual conference last week, which brings together trade unions from across the UK to affirm our priorities. And trade was one of the top priority areas that was discussed. And that set out that for working people, we need trade deals that protect a high standard of workers' rights, protections for public services, and to make sure that good jobs are promoted rather than a race to the bottom and more precarious work. And in order to do that, our Congress affirms that we need to involve working people in trade negotiations, because unless we can input into the text of those negotiations, we aren't going to get the outcomes that we need for working people and for our public services. And our priority in order to affirm those goals for working people is to secure a good trade deal with the EU, which for us is one with zero tariffs, low barrier trade and services, and dynamic alignment on the high standard of rights that are found in the EU. And we do, as the union movement, see severe threats in the current state of play of UK negotiations with the EU. Obviously, the UK government is prepared to break international law and undermine the withdrawal agreement, and thus the prospect of getting the good deal we need with the EU. And obviously, we see a range of threats from the potential of a trade deal with the likes of Trump, but also Australia, and the prospect of joining the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership. These are all bad trade deals, and trade deals that potentially risk our rights and risk locking in privatisation of the NHS, and trade unions have not been involved and able to input into those negotiations. So we do see a range of threats to our objectives, which is for trade to promote good jobs, workers' rights and protection for public services, as well as other social standards.
Let's come back to some of that in terms of the risks, because you've flagged up some pretty big deals there. All of those are priority deals at the moment, of course. So let's come back to those in the conversation. Let me just switch to you, Ruth, from the Trade Justice Movement. What are your priorities for your constituency?
Thanks, Chris. So I think, our reason for being is that we have been critical of trade rules and the trade system for nearly the past 20 years. And I think our kind of driving principle is that trade is a means to an end. It's not an end in itself, and it needs to support our ambitions in other areas, in areas like the Sustainable Development Goals, and in areas like tackling climate change and biodiversity loss. And I think those principles are even more important than ever. I mean, the news about climate change and biodiversity loss seems to be only getting worse. Clearly, we now need a trade system that helps us to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. And we are really worried that actually the trade system is just not fit for purpose at the moment. When you look at the WTO, appears to be in complete stasis. You know, we've seen the US blocking the appointment of judges to the dispute settlement mechanism. That's really not going to help. But actually, beyond that, we think a kind of fundamental review of the purpose and powers of the WTO is long overdue. And that especially now that we have so many new challenges that we need to urgently face, actually, the WTO needs a real overhaul to make sure that it's fit for purpose. In the UK, we appear to be operating in a context where there's very little in the way of strategy for our new trade policy. So the sort of driving principle seems to be to pursue new trade deals for the sake of new trade deals. So just to run after as many trade deals as possible, very little indication of how partners are being selected, how the content of trade deals is being decided. And like Rosa, we're really concerned about scrutiny provisions. There's very little set out by the government at the moment in terms of scrutiny, and certainly almost nothing in legislation. Lots of concern in Parliament here about that. 5 different committees raising concerns. Partners from across business, trade unions, civil society, all saying that it's just not good enough. And there has been no action on that at all. So I think in terms of our priorities, those are top of the agenda. But underneath that, actually, there's a really big conversation to be had about the shape of trade policy in the UK and globally for the 21st century.
We'll come to some of that actually in the question a little bit later on the role of multi-stakeholders, non-business stakeholders in the negotiation process, particularly around the scrutiny area as well, and trade governance in general. Ben, in terms of Unite, are your priorities different from what Rosa set out, or are they the same?
I think in general they're very much the same, and I think rather than, you know, repeat a lot of those, you know, really important points that Rosa made, I think it's just reinforcing that if you're talking about the number one trade priority, obviously, you know, a lot of the discussion and the government discussion is on trade agreements with, be it the United States, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, etc. But our number one priority still remains a trade agreement with the European Union along all those lines that Rosa put forward. And I think that's the number one because that's where the vast majority of our trade is done through. That's where the jobs that our members have are dependent on, the supply chains that they're involved in that have developed over those last 40 years. But I think more generally in terms of sort of the trade priority, Unite is a union that represents members across the public sector and the private sector, manufacturing and services. So I think our key is looking to the UK needs a trade policy approach that ensures that all sectors benefit from trade, in that, you know, we don't see a case where one sector is played off against another, but actually, you know, trade is being done in a way, and it goes back to points that both Ruth and Rosa made, that the widest possible groupings in society are actually benefiting from trade, rather than perhaps, as we've seen in the past, where the benefits of trade have been, you know, much more limited. And actually, in many cases, there's been a negative impact on working people on some of the trade agreements that have been negotiated around the world.
Let's go straight into the trade governance issue, because, you know, for those who are listening from outside the UK may not have picked up that there's been a review of the, we call the trade advisory groups. Those are the forums that are feeding into government on trade negotiations. In the recent review, this is a sort of week or two ago, everyone who was a non-business stakeholder got removed from the process, except one small forum, which is not connected to all the sort of more sectoral, meaty forums where specialists and experts are feeding in. That's a really significant issue, isn't it? I mean, how do we create a process by which we build public trust that where people can see that we're working together, so we've got the voice of workers and the voice of NGOs and civil society and everybody else and business together, feeding into government, giving advice that we all sort of agree to in terms of consensus. I'm aware that some of these issues are not easy. How do we do that in the current climate where you're not involved in the process? It's just business stakeholders. Maybe, Ruth, I'll start with you. What's your view on that?
So this is something that we've worked on really for a very long time. I mean, at least 10 years, if not longer. And I mean, the context, I think, is important to remember is that trade deals these days are not just about the movement of goods across borders. As I'm sure people listening to this know that already, but it's worth restating. It's not just about the movement of goods across borders. It covers almost every aspect of daily life. So the way that we provide services, food standards, you know, healthcare, so many different aspects of life. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so important that there's public buy-in, that there's the engagement with as many people as possible to get really good quality trade deals agreed. And what's really worrying, disappointing, frustrating about this state of play in the UK is that the government just doesn't seem to see that actually it gets better trade deals and more a greater likelihood of getting those trade deals through Parliament and having support from the public if it engages properly. So as you've said, we appear to have been downgraded. So business groups now have trade advisory groups that they're members of. I know that they've been asked to sign non-disclosure agreements, and I understand that some of them weren't very happy about that. I think the non-disclosure agreements were reviewed. We were asked to sign one, but the reviewed versions we still are yet to see. And we are not an advisory group or a working group, and there has been no clarity about what that means, about why we've all been excluded from the sectoral groups. And when I say we, I mean it's civil society organisations, NGOs plus trade unions and academics. It looks, from last time I looked at the groups, like there were no academics on board, which is really difficult to understand, short-sighted. So I think at minimum, we should be seeking to match what the EU and the US already have. I mean, we've got to have negotiations with these key partners. And much more information is flowing between government officials and civil society and business in those countries' trading blocks than here. Parliamentarians in the EU will get a much bigger say over the trade deal than we will here. Although, I mean, with the caveat that it's possible they make some exceptions here because they know the EU deal is so important. But when it comes to, say, a deal with the US, MPs here will get 21 days to see a finalised deal and that's it. There's no guarantee of a vote. So we really have so far to go in terms of actually establishing a proper process. But proper engagement, proper consultation with the right kinds of information available to everyone. And I think it should go as far as engaging with communities. Once you know that there are certain communities and sectors that are going to be impacted, I think you need to engage directly with those. And I think it's about having a conversation about that, which isn't happening at the moment because the ideas are out there and we've all come together to put some of that on paper. For some reason, it's just falling on deaf ears when it comes to the government.
It is quite extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, it sort of runs against, this is the point we made when we first did the trade model that works for everyone. I remember making the point from ICC that this is almost undemocratic, isn't it, really? It sort of runs against the values of UK and UK's traditional role in trade in terms of promoting the rule of law and democracy. We seem to have somehow got ourselves in a position where people have not got a voice, etc. Rosa, what are your views on this? It's quite serious stuff, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean, I build on a lot of those concerns that Ruth raised. I mean, for working people, it's absolutely essential that we have a say in the content of those trade agreements. The impact of tariffs on the sectors across our economy will have a severe impact on jobs, potentially. So it's very important for unions to be able to comment on those. But also the non-tariff areas, the kind of regulations that trade agreements may put pressure to be reduced, or the kind of protections that may well not be in place for things like public services, because that's the direction we've seen trade agreements such as the EU-Canada agreement take, where we didn't have blanket exemption for public services and a range of public services exposed and thus privatisation locked into trade agreements. So when working people are not involved in trade negotiations, the outcomes that we get are severely damaging for working people as well as broader society. And as Ruth and Ben have said, there's no way that the public will support these agreements when they stand to damage our interests, our health, and our crucial public services. So it's really important that we are engaged, and it has been extremely concerning for the TUC and the union movement that we have been cut out of these sectoral advisory groups that we did have seats on, a range of them covering areas such as chemicals and life sciences. Now we are only on the groups that are in the process of being downgraded that cover areas such as development, sustainability, continuity agreements. Very important areas, but these groups have no access to the text of trade negotiations and are really just a one-way process for the Department of International Trade to provide information on talks at a very top-down level. And we're concerned that we see a range of business organisations, over 100 business organisations now, and these upgraded advisory groups where they have to sign non-disclosure agreements, but they will get to see confidential material relating to trade negotiations. And as Ruth highlights, this really stands in stark contrast to our trading partners. We are in very close contact with our comrades in the US. Trade unions in the US are in a range of trade advisory committees where they do get to see the text of trade negotiations and are able to input on the text of trade negotiations. And that has resulted in real improvements to the kind of trade deals the US has negotiated with other countries such as Canada and Mexico with regards to respecting workers' rights. So in the USMCA agreement, there were clauses added in that stopped union busting practices in Mexico as a result of union input. So they're really important improvements. There are lots of other problems we have with US trade policy, but there are some improvements that have been possible because trade unions have that input. And the UK has taken a big step backwards by cutting unions out of the picture, as well as other civil society groups. And we are expressing concern at the highest level to the Department of International Trade. Just to also bring in EU-UK negotiations briefly to say that the Cabinet Office has also been a complete black box when it comes to engagement. There has been zero engagement on the EU-UK negotiations, which as I've highlighted, Ben highlighted, is absolutely a priority area that we get right, and yet there has been no engagement on that. So I think that's a really important area of concern to flag. And also we completely share with the concerns of trade justice movement that Ruth has highlighted around the lack of democratic scrutiny, which means that we don't get the adequate process to get our parliamentarians involved and make sure trade deals benefit working people and broader society.
Yes, it's a good point. We seem to have got ourselves into a place now where we've decoupled businesses from the people who work in businesses and where they live in their communities, don't we? That actually, that's all one thing. And yet, we're only talking to the business entity. And I think what often gets lost in this is it's not really in the interest of business either to sit for years negotiating a deal and then that deal to collapse at the end because key people have not been sort of included in the process. It's not really in the interest of business. Obviously, there was the warning shot this week, wasn't there, from the auto industry on exactly your point. If tariffs come in, then that could spell the end of the auto industry and will certainly damage a lot of jobs in the process, creating almost an unviable sector. It's a big issue. Ben, I'm going to move over to sort of solutions. This is difficult territory. We're in the situation. We are where we are. We're all talking to each other, of course, outside government, you know, across the different stakeholder groups. How do we get to a place where we can build confidence with government that actually what we're saying here is part of the solution, that those outside the process are not anti the process? It's about trying to get to that end deal in a better way with a better outcome by bringing everybody to the table. How do we do that from where we are now? What's the roadmap?
I think that is a really difficult, complicated question. But I think, I mean, at the heart of it, it goes back to, I think, reinforcing that message. And I think the work that we've done through civil society, the trade unions, people like yourself, Chris, and the ICC, and some of your business counterparts who've been involved, have shown the benefit of us having a dialogue around trade policy. So the trade model that works for all, for example, as a first step towards that, shows that there is a common voice between business and trade unions and civil society on what some of these key principles should be. And I think it's reinforcing that point that we're not on opposite sides, if you like, in this. We need, as a trade union, we need good trade agreements, but what we need are good trade agreements, not just any old trade agreements. And I think that's the same for business. Certainly some of the major employers that we work with, they want to hear our voice because they know that we have expertise within this that can lead us to better deals at the end of the day. So I don't think I can give you a clever answer or a one or two step process, but I think it's going to be continually banging on the door of government and saying, you need to let us in, because if you want good trade agreements that will get public support in the future, the only way you'll achieve that is through involving us. That may mean some more difficult conversations in the short term, but it will mean your long-term outcomes are certainly much better when we get to that point. And I think it's forums like this, it's continuing to push government to be more open. I don't think that's going to be easy. I think this government's sort of raison d'etre seems to be to shut down consultation and dialogue rather than open it up more widely. But I think that just means we're going to have to push more strongly for where we do see a space to try and get into it and to raise some of these issues wherever we can.
So actually, it's quite a positive message there, isn't it? You know, it is about getting better long-term outcomes, isn't it? Which I think pretty much everybody wants, don't they? But I guess what I'm hearing from you is we need to be persistent and just keep persuading, cajoling, nurturing and fostering the conversation with the government so actually we're all on the same page. Ruth, can I turn to you? What do you think the roadmap is to get us from where we are now to a better place? As Ben has just rightly said, there is another way. We set that out in the trade model that works for everybody, but there is another way which we think is better. How do we get from here to there?
In a way, it's why this is so frustrating. A lot of the things we're asking for are quite straightforward, actually. And we have models that we can build on from the US, from the EU, from Australia. So it's about, you know, including civil society and trade unions and others in the process from the beginning. You know, the working groups are not a bad model, or at least not a bad starting place. But for example, we found it quite frustrating that we were never sure how our input was being sort of fed up to ministers. The level of information sharing was quite poor. So I think there's lots to do to improve that. You know, once you've got the principle established that unions and civil society should be actually in the room, the second is to ensure that the level of information sharing is sufficient. And I think something that we worried about is the constant refrain that we can't share the text of trade deals because you can't show your hand. Actually, given the sheer scope of trade deals, we think it's really important that we get to see the negotiating text, maybe not right up front, but at a point where there's some degree of confidence that there's an agreement between the parties. Actually, we think it is appropriate for us to see the text because that's the only way we can be really sure about what the impact might be. Also, it's important just to have eyes on it because sometimes we know that officials have got it wrong. When the WTO was established, we know that the US made a number of errors in its listing, thinking that it exempted sectors when it hadn't. So, you know, we have lots of examples of where actually it's much better to allow early kind of eyes on the detail so that you can flag errors. You know, so that's a kind of first step. We also need action in Parliament. So we need to make sure that Parliament's engaged really early on, again, with access to the text as soon as it's, you know, appropriate to do so. We think they need to look at the mandates because actually what you give yourself a mandate to cover is really important in terms of what, you know, how the deal is shaped later. And we want Parliament to have a say in that. We want them to have ongoing scrutiny of the trade deal, so that access to text, and most importantly, a binding vote on the final deal in the UK. So hugely important, and I think a lot to learn from international partners around the world. And again, I would come back to something that where, you know, there's maybe not been quite so much discussion, but I do think it's not beyond the capacity of government to also engage a bit more directly with communities, because I think otherwise, you know, you get communities impacted by these trade deals in ways that haven't been predicted and where there's no mitigation in place. We saw the predictions of the EU of sort of significant job losses, but also job creations, but a real mismatch in terms of the kinds of skills that people losing those jobs had versus the skills that were needed for the new jobs. And I think not enough was done to describe how they were going to bridge that gap.
Yeah, that's a really good point. We don't have a good track record in the UK either, do we, of transitioning from one industrial phase to the next. We know that story from the coal mines and other sectors that are still struggling even today in terms of on poverty indexes and so on. Just final word to you, Rose. I mean, there's some good examples there. There clearly is best practice out there where we can learn. Quite a number of countries, Australia, New Zealand, US, all being named. What do you think? And again, lots of positive messages in terms of early engagement means better outcomes, parliamentary involvement means better trust, community engagement means better mitigation strategies. This all feels like a no-brainer to me. I mean, what's your view to get from here to where we need to be?
I think all of those are really important measures. And I think just the culture of social dialogue that exists in other countries in our continental neighbours such as Sweden and Austria, where there is ongoing dialogue about all kinds of policy, including trade policy, is something that we would want to foster. The government did come together with trade unions and employers to create the job retention scheme as a response to the pandemic. And that was a sign that there was clearly good outcomes that come from this social dialogue approach. Unfortunately, we've seen that fall away. That good work is kind of dissipating, unfortunately. But we would want to see that same constructive approach in the first phase of the job retention scheme to trade negotiations, as well as a whole other range of policy. And as we've outlined here, with unions and as well as civil society have a range of expertise to bring. So I think making those trade advisory groups actually meaningful and including all the right people would be a big step forward. And for that to be the case in the process with EU-UK negotiations as well would be a big step forward in terms of making sure that EU-UK and all the other trade deals fulfil our objectives, and agree absolutely that we need to give Parliament a meaningful role and a role in scrutinising the process. I think, though, just to give a kind of a note of hope, because clearly we have a government that's being fairly unmovable on some of those objectives, at least at the moment, is that I think we've seen a very encouraging group of coalition groups coalescing around this issue. And I think the joint statement that we agreed with ICC, as Ben has mentioned, it was a very important sign that business organisations are on the same page as trade unions and other civil society groups. And I think that you can see that also operating in terms of concerns are raised in the trade bill and the agricultural bill about food safety standards and lowering standards more generally. And I think that coalition advocacy that's going on has had an impact and has meant that the government has had to take notice and certainly has been pushed onto the rear foot, certainly when it comes to things like not only agricultural standards, but other protections that aren't included in mandates and its approach toward trade negotiations now. Also on the issue of scrutiny, they have felt that they have to become more defensive. So I think we can have more of an impact if we strengthen that civil society, employer, trade union advocacy, and also working to build public awareness. And this builds on the point around community engagement. I think there's much more public awareness about the impact of trade on food safety standards, also working conditions, protection of public services and jobs. We certainly found that amongst union members as well. People are joining the dots now. And I think that the kind of public outcry, that threat of a Trump trade deal, for example, on our work conditions, people don't want to hire and fire culture here as found in the US, as well as they don't want hormone-tested beef and all the other low-standard things that you find in the US. So that is one of the reasons why the UK is not pushing forward with the same speed at all on a trade deal with the US. I think we should look at what we've managed to achieve so far and build on those strengths and build on those successes so that we can actually have more of an impact, even if the government does not appear that receptive right now to our arguments.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there is a growing concern, isn't there? Quite a unified concern, isn't it? Depending on, you know, whoever you talk to seems to raise the same issue. You make a really good point around the social partnerships. They are impressive, aren't they, across the sort of particularly Northern Europe. These kind of business government unions all working together. It's a very attractive model. I don't know why the UK consistently sort of ignores it, but it does seem to work, and they do seem to be able to have conversations that we can't for whatever reason. Look, we can talk about this for hours and hours, as we well know. We're going to pull it together, and I think there's been lots of positives from the conversation today. It is just another step forward in the dialogue between all of us, and continue to foster this kind of conversation, because I think, you know, a lot more of it is needed.
If you're interested to hear more on this topic, we'll be discussing it further at the ICC Trade and Prosperity Week starting on the 19th of October. You can register for the event at www.iccwboconference.uk.
Thanks so much to my speakers. Really appreciated. Thanks to the listeners, and look forward to the next time. Thank you.